This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott. And have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it, the phone is ringing again. It's the request line. Oh, we gotta fire that intern. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You've got a crush on your best friend's girlfriend? Dude, that's not cool. You're violating the bro code. What do you mean our podcast is violating the good show code? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Jesse's Girl by 80s dual threat heartthrob Rick Springfield. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line, Rico motherfucking Gnu. How the hell are you?
I'm motherfucking good. How are you, man?
I'm motherfucking good. Not safe for work.
No, please put headphones on. You guys should know this by now. All right. We've got this just in / breaking news, whatever you want to call it. Dickie Betts died. I don't know if there's anybody under the age of probably 40 or 45 who has any idea who this guy is. Scott, can you tell the people out there who Dickie Betts is?
He's dead.
Or who he was, anyway.
Oh, who he was. Okay. He was a guitar player in the Allman Brothers.
Yes. Yes. He was very, pun not intended, very instrumental in just how freaking good that band was. RIP, man. He was 80 years old, had a good run. You know, dying is never an easy thing to deal with, but when you're 80, then hopefully you've lived a life, right? And he certainly, you know, his contributions to music via the Allman Brothers certainly will be remembered by a lot of people. And I usually don't do this. I don't like to tell people what to do, Scott, but I'm going to right now. I'm not asking you, I'm telling you, everybody out there, you have no choice. When you're listen to this episode first, when you're done listening to the episode, go and, let me say it very carefully, go and listen to the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East album. I'm not asking you to do this. I'm making you do it because it is life-altering. Our good friend at My Weekly Mixtape said, with regard to that album, that it might be the best live album ever made. And I don't know if I could argue with that. It's mind-blowing how good it is. When's the last time you listened to it? It's been probably about a half a year for me.
It's been much longer than that. I think the last time I listened to it, one of the local radio stations, I think it was NCX, played it like in its entirety, and I caught it.
Yeah. So if you've never listened to it before, or if you just want to refresh your memory on that, please, I beseech thee, go out and listen to that album. It's available everywhere, and you will not regret it at all.
It's also a terrific sentiment and way to pay tribute to the life of Dickie Betts.
Absolutely. Big time RIP to Dickie Betts. I feel uncomfortable talking about this, Scott, but I kind of feel like we have to, man. Jack Russell, we got to do this, don't we?
Yeah, I think we kind of do.
Yeah. Do you want to fill people in on what the hell we're talking about, since you are the one that kind of broke this?
Well, I don't know.
No, you didn't break it out there, but you're the one that let us in on what the hell's going on.
We'll credit the good folks over at Metal Sludge for compiling several Facebook posts lamenting the performance of one Jack Russell. What does he call? Is it Jack Russell's Great White? Is that how it's branded? Or does he have Great White and the other guys have the second version of touring Great White? There's this weird thing.
I don't even know anymore.
It happened to Queensryche. It happened to Rat. It happened to LA Guns, where you end up with like multiple versions of the same band on the road at the same
time. It's never a good thing when you have to do that.
But to make a long story boring, our man Jack Russell is not in good physical health. And essentially his performance was called, it was referenced to being similar to Weekend at Bernie's, where they literally had effectively a corpse propped up on stage. He was in a chair seated while they had another singer singing many of his parts, a local guy on stage with the band, adding assistance, or as I like to say, just doing the singing. And so the performance, if you want to call it air quotes performance, was just lambasted by anyone in attendance on social media. Fans felt it was inappropriate, that it was shocking, that you effectively are seeing a band touring under his name. Literally, his name is on the marquee, but he's on stage because he is unable to perform, but they're trying to leverage the whatever equity is left in the Jack Russell Great White brand to sell tickets. And so they're just literally propping him up on stage. He just sits there in a chair while the band performs his songs around him. And some local hack gets up on stage and sings his vocals. And so it's just kind of like, you know, we talked about this last week with Twisted Sister and Dee saying, you know, gotta know when to quit. And this is a prime example of just being well past your sell by date. And it's time to hang it up. The sad thing is, and I'll let you get in, is that I don't know how much of this is his doing. You know, obviously there's people around him making money perform with these ticket sales and these performances on this tour. They wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't profitable. So obviously trading on his name is bringing in some cash. The scariest thing to me is I suspect that he himself might maybe need the cash. And that's why even he is going along with this. And maybe the guys on stage aren't taking advantage of him, but rather helping him out by doing these performances. I don't know which it is, but the whole thing feels kind of gross, kind of sad, and just yet another reminder that we're all getting older and the past is slipping further and further behind us. Wah, wah.
Yeah, I know that, you know, fine. I know that he had the neck surgery, and there's allegedly, supposedly some substance issues that perhaps maybe he has been, was, is, you fill in the blank on that, dealing with. And sure, the whole tragedy with the fire that we all know about, surely is always going to be there in his brain. But I agree, man. I mean, I don't know. The dude wouldn't be, he wouldn't be doing this if he wasn't hurting for the cash. I have to feel that way, because literally he is just sitting there like a corpse. He's barely singing anything. And you know what? I have to commend Dan McNay, their bassist. He's really, really sticking up for him too, saying, you know, he has the right to do these shows if he wants to, and I'll, you know, and he's backing him on it, you know, whatever. He's publicly backing him. To your point, he's getting paid by propping his corpse on stage, so I don't know if it's a self-serving comment or if he really believes in sticking up for him or not. I don't know, dude. I don't care. My biggest question is, does this guy have more than one or two songs that are famous enough for him to be doing this? I know one song, Once Bitten, Twice Shy. I know one song. Now, I was never really ensconced in that genre of music back then, and maybe you can, are there more than, this is like the Twisted Sister thing, like you're gonna pay $100 to go see Twisted Sister play five songs that you might know? Like, this is Great White. You're gonna watch a dude that's barely alive on stage for that one song that you know at the very, that they're gonna milk out to the very end. With the very last song, they're gonna roll out Once Bitten, Twice Shy, sung by some other dude besides him. Is that even worth it? I mean, no, it's not. It's, I'm embarrassed for him. I feel bad for him. I know there's got to be another way for him to cash in somehow so that he doesn't have to do this, because it's just not good.
Reading from the Metal Sludge article, this fan comment, this was rough to watch, and it incredibly sad as well. I can't help but think that Jack doesn't really want to do this, but he also can't afford not to, which if true, is sad in its own way. That one of the stars of the 1980s can't afford to retire in peace, or simply can't afford the cancellation penalty for backing out of a show due to health issues. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but if I am, then that means that Jack actually wants to perform in such a state, which is just disrespectful to the fans and to the legacy of the music. So, a couple things. I don't remember. I remember the big hit. They had the hit Rock Me, and they had the Once Bitten, Twice Shy cover that was a big hit. I think Great White was middle of the pack successful in the 80s, which in an era when people were selling millions upon millions of albums in hard rock and metal, I'm not really certain what their certification status is, but I think it's safe to say they were I would call them maybe a club headliner or a stadium opener in the 80s, I think, at their apex. But one thing we've learned is that the 80s have legs, and they're not going away, and people do not want to let go of the 80s, even though it's 40 fucking years behind us now. And these tours for these bands that you and I look at and say, hey, were these bands even that popular? Because we weren't into them. I wasn't crazy about Great White back in the day. But I think, Rico, that as hard as it is for us to wrap our minds around, I think a lot of these bands, and especially in the hair genre, were incredibly meaningful to a lot of people who are now our age and live among us. At work, for example, I have a guy who is two office doors down to me that's a year younger than me, and his favorite band, you want to guess what his favorite band is?
Who?
Poison.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, and he walks up and down the hall singing Poison songs. He's almost 50 years old.
Good God.
These bands, it might not have touched you, and it might not have meant much to me, but these bands meant a lot and sold millions of records and were on MTV 24/7 at a certain point in the 1980s and left an impression on a generation of people. So there's still a market out there, not to be grim, but 100 people burned to death to watch Great White in concert, okay? I mean, so I know it blows your mind, but there is a market. They do a fucking 80s cruise every year.
I'm mind blown, but at the same time, I am forced to give this style of music and this time period of rock and roll, I have to give it its propers, dude, because it's exact for it to have this much momentum still after this amount of time, where they can roll fucking Vince Neil out with a giant boiler and he can't even sing anymore, and they're still selling tickets, and they're rolling this dude out who's barely alive and they're still selling tickets. How could you argue with the impact of that genre of music? How can you, as much as I want to forget that it even happened, I have to give it its due, right?
Let me wrap this up by reading a few more comments from Metal Sludge. And Metal Sludge just took these comments from Facebook. Yep. So I'm just reading from Facebook, a combination of Facebook and YouTube. Yep. This person says, been a fan of his for a long time. What happened? This guy says, no way he makes it a year. This guy says, what happens to him? This guy says, absolutely no reason Jack should be up there. This person just says, sad. This person says, enough is enough. Retire. It's horrible. This is really sad. Jack, just quit. Stop now. This is so awful to watch. 30 seconds of my life I can't get back. You were great back in the day. Find a beach and relax. This person says, as the saying goes, bless his heart. Take care of your bodies, people.
Oh, my God. Well, hey, listen, before we take a break, I don't have a beef against him. I wish him health and happiness. I hope he finds what he's looking for in the rest of his days. But just do it off the stage, do it somewhere else. I was going to talk about Courtney Love and what she said about Taylor Swift, but frankly, she's not worth my time, so I'm not even going to mention it. So,
I love that she said it. But
dude, why does she keep on pissing in people's cornflakes, dude? Like, Taylor Swift is the most celebrated, most popular, most successful musical artist in the entire world right now. And Courtney Love has made it her mission to piss in as many people's cornflakes as she possibly can.
I don't have any problem with what she said. I kind of get it. No, I mean, I think popularity and wealth and her significance as a musician and a business person can't be understated, but I've got, and all that's great, but I think she's talking about, like, I think she's talking about her art and whether or not it's important. And I think that she has a valid criticism there. You can argue she's certainly important to a generation of fans. She's certainly important to the music business and as a trailblazer. But whether or not her art is important, I think there's a legitimate point there that probably needs to be made, because I think people get bowled over by dollar signs and numbers and aren't really kind of like considering that, the validity of the art or importance of it.
Who decides what art is important and what art isn't? Art is way too subjective to say that one art is important and one art isn't. But in Taylor Swift's defense, she has millions and millions of fans that when they listen to her sing and when they listen to her music, it makes them happy. And somebody whose art makes millions of people happy might be a little bit important.
Do you want to go to break?
Yeah. So when we get back, we're going to talk about Noah Drake and glass blowing. All right, we'll be right back.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out, either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host a Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues in the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm, a sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, thanks for sticking with us, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages. Now go find somebody, make them listen that haven't listened before. I think they would not regret it. But having said that, we are going to be talking not about Noah Drake, but about the guy who played Noah Drake. Noah Drake from General Hospital back in the 80s, by the way, was his character, and he was wildly popular on that show. But yeah, that's right. It's Rick Springfield, Jesse's girl from the album Working Class Dog. And yes, I do love the album cover. It's pretty freaking cool. I love that dog and the shirt and tie. But 1981, RCA Records, he wrote the song, produced by Keith Olsen. And we're going to find out if this song killed rock and roll, because I don't fucking know right now. That's why we're doing this, Scott.
I mean, I have no freaking idea if it killed rock and roll. There's only one way to find out, Rico, and that's to use proprietary science. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rock and Roll Autopsy, and you are in the lab. Rico and I have our lab coats on. You know, we look like we could be on the cast of General Hospital, Rico.
That's right.
And every bit as handsome as Rick Springfield, by the way. Every goddamn bit, ladies. Do you understand me?
Preach. Preach it.
Anyway, did it kill rock and roll? We've got to find out. And how do we do that, Rico? Well, we use proprietary science to find out. And that science consists of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. Rico, the artist is Rick Springfield. The album, Working Class Dog. The track in question, Jesse's Girl. The category, gratuitous boomerism. Rico, what say you?
Yeah, so you know how in the Loverboy episode, I described that song as being the soundtrack for 80s yuppie America, right? So just take those people, remove all of the people with the Y chromosome, and what you have left is Rick Springfield's fan base. So essentially what I'm saying here is this is getting a hard one for me, because what we don't have now that we had back then are heartthrob rocker guys that are worshipped by millions of females. That does not exist anymore. We'll maybe get into that a little more as we go. I don't want to blow my wad in the first category, but that is going to be a hard one for me. For gratuitous boomerism.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I agree completely. This is a hard one. One Richard Lewis Spring Thorpe, better known as Rick Springfield, born in 1949, yeah. A youthful 74, if you can believe that. You know, crazy, Rico, man. What a night we're having. 80-year-old Dickie Betts, 74-year-old Rick Springfield, walking corpse Jack Russell, angry Gen X icon Courtney Love. It's just, is there anything of any value that we bring to the world in this podcast? Look at what we're talking about, for God's sake. This shit.
Listen, man.
Listen.
This is why what we do is so goddamn important, Scott, because this needs to be done. Somebody has to do the dirty work here. And we are the people that are willing to do this. It takes a special person to cut open a corpse to find out what killed it. Not everybody can do that. That's why we encourage people to don't try this at home, because you'll fail miserably. We do the dirty work so that you don't have to. It's our lot in life, Scott, and we have to do it.
Thank you. You know, I'm looking at that age. I'm looking at the song. I'm looking at the era. I'm looking at the subject matter. And at this point in the autopsy, I'm left with one choice. Science says that it's a one. Let's move on. Category two, excessive misogyny. Jesse's Girl. Rick Springfield. Rico, I have lyrics available if you'd like to hear them.
Can you speak some golden words to me, please?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if Courtney Love would think these lyrics are art. You know, it was a number one song. So the world apparently says it was art. And it won a Grammy. So this is art, clearly. All right. Jesse is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine, but lately something's changed that ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl, and I want to make her mine. And she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving him with that body. I just know it. Yeah, and he's holding her in his arms late, late at night. You know, I wish I had Jesse's girl. I wish that I had Jesse's girl. Where can I find a woman like that? You need more lyrics, Rico? I'm happy to read more.
No, I'm good. You could probably find, you know, they have like spots called the Bunny Ranch in Vegas that you could probably find one for a few bucks.
And that's why Courtney says this is important art. unlike right. Taylor, because it highlights her chosen profession as an alternative.
Oh, geez. Anyways, so let's talk about Rick Springfield. See, these stories, man, like the stories of how these songs are cooked up just are like, you can't make this shit up sometimes. Jesse's name is actually Gary, by the way. Gary I'm going to save all you guys out and girls and children out there the trouble, and I'm going to tell you the story because Scott, guess what? Nobody reads Wikipedia better than me and you, okay? So let's just get that out of the way. So, yes, his friend's name was Gary, and Gary and Rick and Gary's girlfriend were all taking a glassblowing class. And so that's how this all got started. So Rick started getting the feels for Gary's girlfriend and decided to write a song about it. So that's where this, I mean, I... Dude, between this and the Deep Purple song or story on how they came up with Highway Star, like some of these fucking stories, Scott, I mean, do you think that's true? It's got to be true. It's too weird to be false, right?
A couple things. Number one, yeah. I absolutely would have written the song Gary's Girl because, you know, I love alliteration.
That's right.
But here's why it could have never been Gary's girl. Because Gary doesn't get good looking chicks. We all know a Gary in our life, and Gary isn't hooking up. Gary's not pulling. Gary's not a baller. He's not going to the bar and pulling hot pussy. He's not doing it. We know Gary's. We've all met Gary's.
Well, apparently Gary's from Australia can pull some hot pussy because apparently this one did. Either that or Rick Springthorpe doesn't have very good taste in girls. One of the two, I'm not sure. But excessive misogyny, okay. In today's eyes, Scott, what today's woman would say is, how dare he objectify a woman and treat her like a commodity that can be traded like frozen orange juice on Wall Street. See, that's today. That's why this score has to be a 1.0. It has to be for that reason. On the other hand, what's really happened? Go ahead.
No, you go. I'm giving it a one.
On the other hand, what really is happening here is the girl or the female, listen, I was looking up some message boards and there are still females who are publicly professing their love for this man at 74, 40 years later, okay? So the female who's listening to this song in 1981 is not saying that. You wanna know what they're saying, Scott? They're saying, I know you're talking to me. I'm Jesse's girl, and I will break up with my goddamn piece of shit boyfriend in 1 second for you because I know you want me, and I will do this for you, Rick, because I love you, and this song is about me. I know it. And that's not translating to now. Now girls get pissed because no man is going to give them identity. I will give myself my identity. You see, and back then, from a certain point of view, girls were getting their identity from shit like this. Like girls, when this song was really famous, Scott, girls back then wanted to be wanted, right? They wanted to be coveted. And when they listened to this song, it made them feel wanted and it made their heart flutter and it made them get a little bit sweaty and it made them stare at Rick Springfield with them puppy dog eyes in a way that doesn't translate to now. And that kind of when in today's society, the thought of that kind of an interaction taking place makes people sick. And so that's why it's got to get a plus one for misogyny for me.
Yeah, it's a big time one to me. Oh, yeah. This is total objectification of, I mean, this Jesse's girl, she doesn't even have a name. It's just actually she's like Frankenstein. She's named after the doctor. She's just Jesse's girl. She's literally Jess, and also it's the ownership of Jesse's girl. It's like she's property that Jesse owns. It's like Jesse had a sweet Trans Am back in 1982 that Rick wanted to drive that around too. Jesse's property. He just wants to live in Jesse's house. He wants to have his girl. He basically wants to be Jesse. So yeah, it's a plus one big time for me. It's just objectification. She's not even a human. She's just an object. And all he wants is what she is giving to Jesse. He just wants the late night sex session. She's loving him with that body, right? He just wants. Oh, he just knows it. It's making him mad. But here is really what needs to be what I need to bring attention to when I look at these lyrics. And this is what sets Jesse's girl apart and makes it the work of artistic merit that we know it to be. Rick Springfield is probably the only artist in music history to use the word moot in a song. And he rhymed it with cute. So you got to let me read it because the lyrics are brilliant.
Do it, man.
He literally uses the word moot. I love it. Okay. I mean, Rico, this song has to have some place in rock and roll history of some great significance because I play along with the charade. There doesn't seem to be a reason to change. You know, I feel so dirty when they start talking cute. I want to tell her that I love her, but the point is probably moot.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. Like his boy, hey, nothing more can be said about, I mean, Michael Stipe and his lyrics got nothing on this. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah. I mean, and when Sting was penning the Lolita inspired, you know, I'm forgetting the name of the song. Don't stand so close to me. You know, just brilliant lyrics. But yeah, here we have, but the point is probably moot. And it's the clumsiest line too. Oh, I want to tell her that I love her, but the point is probably moot. How did he even sing that? I mean, it's so ham-fisted, the writing. Oh, this was a number one song, Rico. What a Grammy. Oh, so this is art, I guess, but it's so the lyric is so ham-fisted that it's amazing to me.
You know the funniest part about this girl that we're talking about here? So we know his name, Rick Springthorpe. We know his friend Gary, who he turned into Jesse, but now we know is Gary. Did you know they tried to find who this girl is? Yeah. And they never were able to find out who she was. They even tried to look up the records from the glass blowing class, but the guy who taught the class died and they destroyed the records. So this girl is forever anonymous.
Wow. Unbelievable. All right, let's move on. Category 3, wanton whiteness. Jesse's girl, Rick Springfield. Rico, what say you?
Yeah, of course, this is a solid one. This kind of music even though this song was really, like, again, 98% of his fan base are females, like, I listened to this album a few times now. It's pretty damn good, actually. It's not bad. I mean, listen, let me put it to you, the people out there, and to you, Scott, in terms that maybe us Northeast Ohioans can relate to, like, a maybe not so heart-throbby local version of Rick Springfield would be Michael Stanley, don't you think?
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, Malignant, Wanton Whiteness, right? Yes, super sir. White. This style of music is super white. He's Australian and he's not Aborigine, which makes him ridiculously white, mate. So do you remember if he had an Australian accent when he was on General Hospital? I have no idea.
I don't think so. And let me tell you, man, I went through a phase. Listen, I got hooked on soap operas for a window of time in my life. Dude, I had a job where I worked second shift 3 to 11. So you wake up in the morning and there's nothing to fucking do all day. And you can't really commit to shit because, you know, you have to leave for work at 2:30 in the afternoon. So yeah. I fucking would watch TV. And what's on TV that time of day back then in the 90s? Freaking soap operas, man. So I was watching every single day. You know what my go-to was?
Never General Hospital.
I watched, it was back to back on NBC, Santa Barbara and Days of Our Lives. I watched every day.
Yeah, dude, if I missed an episode of Days of Our Lives, I was killing myself. And do you remember that the guy that used to work at Giant Eagle from my hometown, JU? Do you remember him? He was in Beer and Wine. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
He also watched Days of Our Lives. And if we went more than a day or two without talking about it, like we were in a quilting bee, it was silliness. Like, yes, Days of Our Lives was the show. Bo and Hope, and then Stefano, John Black, Stefano,
Marlena.
Yes, Marlena, who was Electra Woman and Electra Woman and Diana Girl, if you remember that.
Do you know when I bailed on Days?
When?
Do you remember the storyline when Marlena got possessed by the devil?
Yep.
I bailed at that very moment.
Oh.
And you would think, really? And this was, I had like a good 2 years invested in it. Here's one thing that's maddening about soap operas for all you men out there listening to this podcast who've never watched a minute of a soap opera.
I know.
Here's what's maddening.
They all think we're crazy right now.
When you watch TV now, if you pick any Netflix TV show and watch it now, they move the fucking plot forward. Shit moves. Shit happens.
Fast.
Yes. Yeah. And so it makes you binge it, right? In soap opera land, things move at a glacial pace. They never advance the plot.
That's such a great point.
Somehow they manage to make every episode end on a cliffhanger and still have absolutely fucking nothing happen for like a whole season.
Oh, I know.
And it's maddening, you know. But when Marlena got possessed by the devil, I was like, okay, this, for some reason in my brain, I was like, okay, now we're introducing supernatural elements into the soap opera. I am gone. And I bailed on it at that moment.
Hilarious. Do you remember the whole when the guy, the original Roman, left and they brought on the new Roman, and then the old Roman came back, and then they turned the new Roman into John Black, right?
Yes.
Do you remember how long they dragged that shit out?
Yes.
They milked, it was such a good story, but they dragged that shit, like you could come back 6 months later and it was still the Marlena Roman John Black triangle that was still going on.
And I think they did that on purpose because the writers knew these shows were never ending. They were going to be on, that show was on for like 70 years, but but the thing is what they would do is they would have every hour episode would have like five or six plot lines running at the same time, and you'd spend like 3 minutes with each one, and then it would cycle through, you know what I mean? So you'd go 3 minutes on plot one, 3 minutes on storyline two, three minutes on storyline three, then it would start over again. And so by the end of an hour episode, you might have only got like, you know, 7 minutes on that Roman Marlena Black thread, right?
Yeah, and then it moved forward like one micron.
That's
how they can milk it out for so long. But so funny, dude. These people that are listening to us right now have no idea. Like, there were so many closet soap opera watchers back when this stuff was on. I guarantee you that back in the day, people would never, but now everybody will admit to being glued to these fucking shows, man, because everybody was.
But most people watch General Hospital. I would say that Santa Barbara and Days were kind of like, I think General Hospital kind of ruled the soap opera
universe. Do you want to know when I bailed on General Hospital?
When?
When Luke and Laura got married.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was glued until Luke and Laura got married. Then the show jumped the shark. Then I moved on to Days, and it was all downhill from there.
I gotta speak. I gotta move this completely off.
And that's why this category, it's a 1.0 for wanton whiteness, because we spent 10 minutes talking about soap operas.
Okay, I'm scoring. I'm scoring it a one as well. Wanton whiteness. Let's move on before the hour ends. Category Christ. Four, Jesse's Girl, Malignant Machismo. Rico, how do you score?
I mean, we're talking about, okay, so technically this isn't breaking the bro code, right? It's talking about breaking the bro code, but it's not actually breaking the bro code. Right? Dude, can we have a ruling on this?
Is it break? Well, he doesn't act on it, but I mean, it's kind of like if you're lusting after a, you know, well, I mean, I guess Gary is his buddy.
Gary.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of bro code breaking going on here, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, because okay, if he hadn't have acted on it and hadn't written a Grammy winning song about it, then you could say, no, he didn't break the bro code. But writing a song about it, which then became a Grammy winning song and a world famous song that everybody knows, is probably worse than acting on the urge, because now there's probably about 20 million people know that he wanted your girlfriend, right? So I think that's kind of worse than the traditional breaking of the bro code, and it takes a big sack to do that, to be honest with you. So here's why I'm going to dial it back to a half a point, though, because of what I said before. Girls ate this shit up, Scott. They ate it up. They wanted to be Jesse's girl so that Rick Springfield could be talking about them. And that's one of the reasons why rock and roll is dead. Because back then, when rock and roll was huge and popular and this song was popular, there was a gigantic fan base of women that don't exist anymore. And that's why rock is dead. And that's why I dial it back, because we need more people like the Rick Springfields of the world who get more female customers and more female listeners back in the game, because rock was great when there was a lot of female listeners and they're all gone now. And that's why we're talking about it in this podcast. So I'm going to give it a half a point.
I don't know if I should be the one appointed to make a final ruling on the bro code. I'm hardly a qualified arbiter when I just admitted to watching soap operas for the entirety of the 90s.
Yeah.
But Malignant Machismo, listen, man, I just got a comment on this. This has nothing to do with Malignant Machismo, but Rick Springfield, the actor, dude, his credits are every TV show I ever loved as a kid. $6 Million Band, Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew Mysteries, The Rockford Files, Battlestar Galactica, Wonder Woman, The Incredible Hulk, Chips. All of this is before General Hospital. It's every show I ever loved.
Listen, that list might be the pantheon of TV from that area, from that era. Oh. Every one of those shows are TV gold. And the people who didn't get to watch those shows when they were on are lacking a piece of their soul, because those shows were great, man.
He had an episode credit in each one of those. So dude was a working actor long before the 80s rolled around and was in every show.
That's impressive.
Shit back then.
That's all impressive.
Right. Malignant Machismo. Gosh, I don't know, man. You scored it. What'd you score it? A one?
Point five.
A 0.5. Okay. So you broke the streak. We were solid ones across the board.
Yeah, I broke the streak.
Well, you know what? I happen to agree.
Because he was very instrumental in a gigantic fan base of female rock listeners. So I had to dial it back.
He must have been like just exhibiting some desirable masculinity. So I'm going to go ahead and give him a 0.5 as well. Let's move on to our final category, culture vulturism. Rico, the track is Jesse's Girl, Working Class Dog. Great album title. The artist, the multi-talented Rick Springfield. Rico, what say you? Culture vulturism.
Well, see, this is where I can't give a score on this. I mean, you know, if you read Wikipedia, obviously not as good as we read Wikipedia, but you will see that he had a very lengthy career in music before this album came out. And I feel like it's not culture vulturism, because it's okay for, in this particular instance, you know, he was just kind of trying to feel things out, trying to settle on a particular musical style that worked for him and something that could, he could be happy with. And yeah, there's nothing, you know, this style of music is really of the time. We've used that term a lot on this podcast, and this song fits right in there with that. It's a very early 80s style. It's heartthrob rock that's written in a major key, not a minor key, which is why girls like it, because major key rock is kind of uplifting and happy, even if it's not. And so he's not reinventing the wheel by no means, but surely he's not ripping anybody off. He's just kind of settled into a sound that he could be happy with that just happens to be of the time. I don't really think there's anything wrong with that. That's a zero for me.
Yeah, I think what you're identifying is we talked about this during the Loverboy episode. This exists in that little kind of window of time when the 70s and the 80s were still kind of a mushy blur, and the 80s hadn't really become the 80s as we identify them today. Yep. And so, yeah, it's just a power pop song that sounds like it's a bosom buddy song. It has that, talked about this during the Loverboy episode. Doesn't rock as hard as Working for the Weekend. It's a little more radio friendly, although gosh, what could be more radio friendly than Working for the Weekend? But it's even softer. It's pop. It's power pop.
Yep.
Just some polite downpicked rhythm guitar kind of just, you know, propelling the song forward. You know what I mean? Nothing's too aggressive. Nothing's gonna at all kind of like offend the ears. You know, it's all it's all packaged nicely.
Some really nice harmony that sounds really good and very uplifting.
Yep. I'm going to give it a zero as well, Rico, for culture vulturism. I don't see any. All right. You want to tally these up?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Well, let's see. I've got. Oh, boy. This is going to be interesting. I've got a 3.5, Rico. What have you got?
I also have a 3.5
for a grand total of
7.0. Sorry.
Guilty. You know, it's fucking Gary's fault. Can we just say it for what it is?
Yeah. No, it totally is. If you have to change, listen, I mean, I guess there's nothing inherently wrong with the name Gary. I work with a Gary. He's been on another podcast that we do. However, if you have to change the name and call him something different, that's a problem, dude. That's a big problem.
Yeah, and actually, it's funny because if this was Rick Springthorpe singing about Gary's girl, I mean, does any of this even make sense 40 years later? It's like Back to the Future. You go back and you just change a couple things and all of a sudden the world is completely different.
Gary's Girl by Rick Springthorpe. I don't think it would have the same effect for some reason. I'm not sure why.
Like, it never happens. I mean, this was the number one song when MTV started. None of that happens. Oprah's not looking for, you know, Jesse's girl 40 years later.
He doesn't land that role on General Hospital.
No.
He doesn't have those sweet-ass cameos in that list of amazing shows.
No.
And maybe Rick Springfield winds up taking up glass blowing as a career.
Rick Springthorpe, glass blower and hopelessly single as Gary weds his his girlfriend, and
as he eternally covets his friend's girl, knowing damn well that he doesn't have a shot in hell at her.
Rick Springthorpe furiously masturbating to the bra section of the Penny's catalog for the rest of his life. For the rest of his life, he's glass blowing during the day, and he's just can't wait to get home and rub one out
in the newly created glass bowl that he made earlier in the day as a collection bowl, neatly decorated. Oh my God, what a sad life he would have had.
Oh my gosh, how the world. And this episode of Rock and Roll Autopsy would never have existed.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Like sands through the hourglass, Scott.
Oh, nice.
So are the days of our lives.
Nice. All right. Well, I can't end it any more poetically than that. Nice callback. All right, gang, it's been Rock and Roll Autopsy. We've all lost a few IQ points tonight. Tune in next week if you
if you want to. I don't think we had very many to give at this point in time, do we?
All right, gang, it's been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Rico, have a good night, man.
You too, buddy.
All right, good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, sir, the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mistake. There's no mistake anymore.
To the dawn, love it till the morning. I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica, and Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.